Hi, I'm Orbert Davis, and welcome to the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Jazz Cast Series, where we sit down with music legends as well as rising stars to hear their stories. This monthly series is all about sharing experience and knowledge with you. Thanks for tuning in. For more, visit chicagojazzphilharmonic.org. Let's do it.
All right, all right. Welcome, everybody, to the CJP Power Hour podcast. I'll tell you a little bit about some of his accomplishments so we can have an idea with that. This world-renowned composer score has worked with scoring legends such as Danny Elfman and Christoph Beck. He conducted a string orchestra for the 2019 ESPY Awards. He's provided music scoring for the Netflix original series, The Christmas Chronicles and The Christmas Chronicles 2. He plays a mean alto saxophone too. I'm talking about like David Sambor meets Hank Crawford, Charlie Parker, Cannonball Adderley. Yeah, I didn't forget that. has scored over 23 feature films, including films such as Proximity and the movie Canvas. And of course, most recently, Coming to America, which featured Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. Jermaine, how are you doing, man? It's so good to see you.
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm excited to see you too. And you just got such good energy. That's a good thing.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you. Thank
you. I'm excited. And first of all, you said plays a mean alto sax. I'm just like, did you guys hear Mike?
Well, you know, so to give a little bit of backstory, Jermaine and I, we both went to Northern Illinois University.
Yep.
And my first time meeting Jermaine was actually in the lab band and also being a part of the saxophone studio. Yep. You know, I was a wily freshman, had no idea what was going on. And Jermaine was like that cool side of the pillow in the summertime. Whenever I was stressing, I was crisis, Jermaine was like, it's going to be okay, brother.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. So actually, you know what? Let's go back. I was thinking about just going through things chronologically, if that's okay.
That sounds great.
Okay, cool. Awesome. So now, stop me if I'm incorrect, but you're from, you grew up in Joliet,
is that? Yep, is that? Joliet, Illinois. Okay. And went through the music program there. I started what was considered a year late at that point. You know, most students start in fourth grade. I started in fifth. And by the time I got to sixth grade, I jumped pretty much straight into the jazz interests with going to J.B. Abersold's jazz camps that they were having back then. Mm-hmm. And I have a quick question, because if I fast forward to my senior year in high school, we may touch on the fact that there is a thing called, I don't know if it still exists, but the Grammy Midwest All-Star Jazz Band that at the time was held at DePaul University. They used to do a thing every year. It was like a 2 or 3 day clinic. So correct me if I'm wrong, is Orbert Davis still involved with the CJP or no? Or was he ever?
Yeah, so Orbert is the CJP.
Oh, he is the CJP. So I bring that up because I feel like, I don't know if he's on this call, but I feel like I met him through that Midwest All-Star Jazz thing, which, I mean, you and I remember Mark Beening. He was someone that you and I were at school with, but he was in the ensemble that I was in. And then our friend Jerry Lowry was, I think, the year before us. Mark and I, but I met Orbert through that. Somehow, I don't know if he went to the concert or whatever, but for some reason, Orbert and I were, and this is cool, that this is why I was like, so whatever you guys need, I'm on board. But as far as him being involved in this, back then, after I did that, like I would say I was probably in touch with him for like the next 20 years or so.
Oh, wow.
Just off and on, just talking about different things. And he always sent me, you know, encouraging notes, and like it always stuck out how intentional he was about just the encouragement and the fact that I was actually doing something with, you know, pursuing an actual career in music. So I know I fast forwarded a little bit in terms of going through high school, but you know, I started saxophone in junior high, did the jazz bands 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And then when I got to high school, I was pretty heavily interested in jazz as far as how I would incorporate saxophone into the, you know, the being a musician. It wasn't about being a composer back then. It was just about being a performer and a player and playing solos and doing solo and ensemble contests. And then, like I said, fast forwarding to senior year, I ended up doing that Grammy All-Star Jazz Band, which was something I hadn't heard of until senior year in high school. But I did meet Orbert through that, which is just kind of a funny thing, which was like a little segue into our time meeting at Northern. And, you know, again, jazz just kept being one of those things that stuck out as a major influence as far as, you know, what we call, you know, American music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, you know, whenever I do, you know, these chats, you know, whether students involved, like I always like to point out that when we bring up jazz, like, you know, we think about what is our music as a culture in terms of being an American, you know, being a proud American, like American music, like jazz is really, it's something that really represents the melting pot that is this country, you know, and that really is in a, you know, an amalgamation of all these different styles, all these different cultures, which is, it's so important to think about that. Cause when we think of what we think of as on the radio or what's popular or popular music, a lot of that comes from, it stems from jazz, but jazz really is, it's our language, which is this thing in terms of America. For me, it has to do with bringing all the cultures together. And I just think that's an important thing to think about because I try to incorporate that in terms of my philosophies on music, which has to do with what are all the things that influence me, not just one thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I know that's a long-winded answer.
No, man, that was deep. Like I'm going to have to get a t-shirt made of that. It's going to be a long t-shirt, but I'm going to get it made.
A long t-shirt, yeah.
Because, like, man, those are such important mantras, you know, to embrace, you know, what we're passionate about, and figure out ways to, you know, share that with the world.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Along those lines, you know, if it's okay, we can kind of like transition into from high school into Northern Illinois.
Yeah. Okay. It's funny. I have to tell you. So our saxophone teacher, I just happen to have this here. Steve Duke just sent me a recent CD that he, Steve Duke and I, this is a picture of him here. This is the guy that taught Mike Salter and I almost everything we know. 60%. This guy, you know, he's a great friend, great teacher. And when I went to Northern to study, and he's since retired, but, you know, I think about three weeks ago, we reconnected. We talked about you and all the different students that have gone on. And he says it's amazing how the performance majors, a lot of them really, and not just performance majors, but saxophone specifically, a lot of them really pursued, even if it wasn't saxophone, seriously pursued music and are still actively doing stuff, which is a very shocking thing that, whether you be teaching or leading a thing or interested in the thing or composing or whatever, like a lot of people were really hungry and went after doing stuff. And I attribute a lot of that, you know, Steve Duke was always an embracer of whatever you're interested in, how can we incorporate that into sax? So when I got, you know, as you talk about, you know, getting to Northern, you know, in undergrad, when I got there, you know, obviously saxophone performance was the interest and the major focus, but when I started talking about composition, I would say about 2 years into it, like 97 or so, he kept asking, you know, how can we incorporate that into your degree? Because Mike, I don't know if you remember me trying to switch my major to composition several times. And I kept going to the faculty and submitting portfolios of compositions. And Steve would say, okay, so if that's not working for whatever reason, you know, he even points out now when we were on the phone a couple of weeks ago, he was like, you're very diplomatic in how you how you handle the fact that you weren't being allowed into the composition department in terms of what they saw as a composer and being a university. He always encouraged me to bring these saxophone quartet pieces that I had written to quartet rehearsals. And sometimes we would play them at our recitals or whatever. But, you know, it's like, how can you make what you already do a part of the thing that you're already focusing on, you know?
Sorry to interrupt. If I can interject, I remember your senior recital And I remember you playing the Steagle. And that was like, that opened, that was like, wow.
Yeah.
Because it was exactly what you talked about. You know, it was just like, you know, traditionally saxophone quartet is for a classical setting, classical music. But you had some gospel in there, some
jazz, a little bit of everything. So it's like, I don't think I knew even back then, how is this all going to tie together? You know, and even now, like, okay, so for, I'm working on a kind of a scary movie right now, but my next movie is going to be this upbeat teen rom-com, which is like, you know, we go back to high school. And the idea for me, my pitch when they approached me was, you know, what can we do that's fun and energetic? You know, because I think of energy when I think of high school, and a lot of people think of fun, not everybody. but the idea, even for now, my pitch has to do with a lot of the things that I was influenced with. So it's not necessarily going to be gospel, but, you know, my version of high energy rock, or, you know what I mean? Like those things, it's like, what are those things that influence you? How can you make that work for the narrative? You know, and this, in this, you know, case, it's, you know, kind of a romantic comedy, but it's just fun. It's energy, it's silly, it's over the top, it's broad. But you know, you really have to figure out what's your version of that and then know what it is so that you can really go for it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And, you know, if it's okay, I want to come back to that, you know, in terms of your approach to, you know, when you accept a project, how to get into it and find your avenue and your
Let's come back to that, because there's a lot of that going on now in terms of being pitched for stuff, and then you can't just say I want to do it because I want to work. You know, they want to know, what in the world are you going to do that's going to actually be a value, adding value to it? What way? Why you? It could be anybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, I want to come back to that. But before we get to that, I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned a second ago that I think could be a really valuable lesson for this the students listening. You know, you talk about how at Northern, you know, you're a saxophone major and you wanted to change your major to composition.
Yep.
You know, but the composition teachers and faculty were kind of like, no.
No.
Like
not so many words, but no.
Hold up, wait a minute. so, you know, I think for a lot of people like myself, you know, at like getting that kind of feedback at that time, it could have been like very like stifling, like in terms of like, okay, well, maybe I won't do this.
Yep.
You know, forget this.
Yep.
How did you take that experience and still, you know, stay true to your course and say, well, you know what? If they don't agree to it, I'll figure out something else.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, for me, you know, some of these things that we do as artists, like it has to do with kind of feeling this, you know, innate calling, so to speak, like you have to do it. Like, I honestly feel like I was pretty sure I was like, I have to tell myself, look myself in the mirror and say, this is going on the back burner. I'm not going to pursue this fully because it's not a thing that's, you know, supported for me in my case in the academic institution. And I always really was a big fan and advocate for academia. Like, you know, when you're in school, like for me, I felt like if I was going to approach things, like I wanted to approach it the academic way, I'm going to go to school for it. Then I have a degree that says that I can do that thing. And then that's my endorsement. But for me in school, like I was never sure, you know, I can't openly say that, you know, there was some kind of prejudice against the color of my skin specifically with being, you know, it crossed my mind at the time. There wasn't a lot of black composers as far as our specific school of students that made up the composition department. I think there were about 20 students, undergrad and graduate combined, in the composition department. And I'm pretty sure I was the only one that was black. But when it came to and this is more of a universal thing, even when it came to graduate school later, when I got to North Texas, commercial music or writing music for film or TV, those are generally things that aren't, you know, the faculties at academic institutions aren't excited about commercial music and music for film and TV in academic scenarios, from my experience, except for the schools that really capitalize on it, like Berkeley's and schools that are in Los Angeles. Like there's obviously Musicians Institute, which is a big thing. I went to USC. That's a, you know, probably one of the most epic for film scoring specifically, because you're in the heart of Los Angeles and it's more directly related to finding filmmakers or people that are going to television after school and could potentially hire you again. So when you're in those environments where the whole town has an industry that's, you know, embracing this, it makes more sense. Florida, I think they still have a pretty big school for, you know, commercial music writing. North Carolina School of the Arts, you know, there's a lot of arts schools that are way more open to that. But for me, when it, like you said, as it comes to, you know, hearing the no, and, you know, I was submitting whole portfolios of compositions that were original to their request and told, you know, either A, we don't have enough teachers, which is like, okay, is not that, you know, you have that giant of a demand when you're running out of teachers to teach 30 minute lesson per week or whatever. But then it really became about getting people together, asking questions of other composers, what are you guys doing? And really it had to do with get people together in a room, have them play your stuff, record it, listen back to it, decide how you can make it better. Do you like it? I mean, you know what I mean? That's the, really a question. Do you like it? I'm sure you remember Steve Duke telling us to record ourselves practicing. Do you like what you hear? At least, you know, if he didn't say that, I know his teacher, Jim Riggs, who I was also able to study saxophone with at North Texas, used to ask that question. Do you like what you hear? When you record yourself and play it back, do you like what you hear? And that's a huge question. Like, it's not about like, I created this, so of course I like it, but is it pleasant to your ear? If not, this is an opportunity for you to make some changes while you're in school. You're not being paid to do this stuff all the time or fired based off your tone or whatever. Like, if you really don't like it, then study you guys a lot, you know, that you like, incorporate what they have into your style and continue honing that thing. And, you know, as you said, you know, my senior recital, I think I had two of them. You know, I started to more and more incorporate more stuff that I thought was working for me. I listen back to it now, I go, ah, you know, but at the time it was very much a growth thing to be excited about these things that I didn't know that I could create. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, man, all of that to me is super inspiring, man. And you've always been kind of like that big brother inspiration figure for me, because it's true, man, because, you know, like when I was in school, you know, for jazz, you know, this was like late '90s, right? School, you know, jazz programs were pretty binary, you know, like you studied, you worked on big band and bebop. And, you know, there are some other things thrown in there, but that was pretty much it, right? There wasn't a whole lot of appetite for world music or Latin music. And so to, you know, to have your kind of self-awareness and self-centeredness to say, this is me, and I'm gonna do me, and y'all can get on board or not, but well, hey,
I'm gonna figure out eventually. And that's why I love that I don't know if it's merengue or a salsa music that was being played on the break or whatever, like, because that reminds me of a time where I went down this giant rabbit trail of that style of music, honestly, when I was at North Texas. Just a side anecdote, I was on this mission to find my wife, who I felt like in my mind was going to be a dancer. I don't know why, but, you know, that conversation in my own head led me to, you know, a moment where my wife and I ended up going to do, at the time, you know, before we started dating, taking salsa dance lessons for several weeks. And then on our first couple of dates, honestly, you know, going salsa dancing as a thing that was an extension of the dates, which, you know, it's funny, you know, after we got married and had the wedding reception, salsa dancing was our first dance. And then we kind of like, it's the last time we salsa danced was the wedding reception 18 years ago, but it's kind of funny. But anyway, like that music, like for me, like reminds me of a time where I was like buying salsa dance CDs and studying artists. And I knew people that were in salsa bands in Dallas and was like finding out where they were playing. And like, it just was very interested in the music and the culture. And, food, all these things. Like, it was like a whole thing. It's like this giant melting pot that, you know, you don't really think about it, but it's becoming a part of what speaks to you and what lets you know you're on the right path, you know. And when you're young, I'm telling you, like, this is the time to go down those musical rabbit holes and go as deep as you can with each style and each genre, because it just informs so many different, you know, scenarios that you're going to find yourself in later, whether you're professional or not. You're just going to, if you continue to talk to people and meet people on the street, you're going to find yourself in scenarios where you got to communicate musically.
If you're
musician, at least.
Yeah, that, man, brother, that's like so on point. Like, I couldn't agree more, you know, in terms of like all of these, you know, passions and musical rabbit holes, eventually they contribute to who we become as a musical individual and as a person, you know.
Yep,
you so whether it's like Gregorian chant or, you know, like Mongolian throat singing or whatever, you know, it all, you know, adds up and becomes a part of who we are. The mosaic, the tapestry of who we become as musicians, you know.
It does.
And it's so funny, man, because I feel like we're on parallel lines, because, you know, I went down this huge salsa merengue path.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, you know, because Rich Moore and I, we played in the salsa bands for like...
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
More, you know? Uh-huh. And, you know, like, for me, that experience, like, man, it helped my rhythm so much.
Yes.
Like, jazz, you know, because, like, I had to play percussion in one of the bands. And that got my rhythm, like, you know. But, you know, so it's so funny, man.
Yep.
So to keep the line going, you know, you mentioned North Texas, right?
Yep.
So you finished up at Northern Illinois.
Yep.
You're like, okay, peace out. Y'all ain't gonna let me study composition.
Yeah. So the first thing I did, if you remember the recital, I'm sure you were at where I did the gospel thing at the end. Everyone was wearing red. That night, several people from the faculty from NIU came up to me and were kind of like, whoa, we had no idea. It was kind of like, it's funny, like I'm graduating and now we're saying we had no idea. I'm going to call USC and try to get you into that program. I'm like, okay, well, it's only a week, you know, left. That's kind of not going to work. What happened was I got rejected from the, you know, when I gave that concert, I had, you know, three rejection letters from USC, their regular straight composition department to do a master's in composition, UCLA, and also another college, Mills College in California, where I thought, you know, after NIU, I'm going to LA. I'm just going to start. Here we go. And I got rejected. So when I gave that concert, it was just kind of this funny point where I was like, I had all this momentum in my mind. I was going to do a concert and then be like, see, I'm going to LA too. And that didn't work out. So I was really encouraged because half the school, as you remember, at NIU's faculty had all gone to North Texas, including Steve Duke and so many others. So they all kind of said, look, why don't you just look at their website and see what the deadline is? Just see what the requirements are to get in. No promises. Just see what it's like. Just entertain the idea. So I looked at it. And the only person I knew at the time, you probably remember Joran Kane, who was also a student at NIU. Mm-hmm. He was at North Texas. So he allowed me.
Jeremy, can I interject real quick?
Yeah.
Just so everybody, all the students understand, like, North Texas, you know, in terms of jazz education at the university level, Orbit, sign off on this, make sure I'm saying this correctly. North Texas was the first jazz program, right, at the university level? Is that correct?
I believe so. Hey, Jermaine. Nice
Orbit,
to see you.
Are you on this?
Yeah.
So let me stop before you answer that question and say you've been one of the most encouraging individuals I've ever seen. I told them, I would say 15, 20 years, you were following and encouraging and sending all these messages that I was just like, I don't know why this guy is so encouraging, but like, it seems very intentional and it seems very genuine. So thank you for that.
Man, thank you so much. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, ditto to that. Ditto.
But I never forgot that. Yeah.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. But I don't know the history, but I remember reading a lot about, especially when education programs were so polar, that North Texas came in under the direction, actually, it was Stan Kenton.
Yep, Stan Kenton. He's the guy that helped start the whole program.
Yeah.
And so donated a library of charts, apparently.
That's right.
That were original arrangements to the band. To the school.
That's where you get that big band foundation too, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, that was the place to go, North Texas. And then the University of Miami became hot. And then, of course, schools in New York.
Yep. Yeah. New York.
Yeah. Yeah, back in the day, it was the 1 o'clock band, right? Like, if you made the 1 o'clock band.
That's the whole thing is there's a culture, honestly. And so to my little thing is, obviously, as a saxophone player, I just studied under Steve Duke. His teacher, Jim Riggs, was there. I was going there because for me, it was one of the only places I can get into at the time to further this momentum I had of I'm trying to figure out how to be a composer. And I got in as an undeclared major. And when I got to campus, it's just like, so Joran, our friend from NIU, he was like, I don't know. I saw this posting on a board saying looking for a roommate. I just said yes to whoever it was. Everybody in the house played jazz. Like there was a drummer, a saxophone, it was just like everybody was going there for jazz. They were like, oh, notorious for having jam sessions at the house, all these things. Like even just a random post like that, that's kind of the vibe of it. For instance, so saxophone at Northern Illinois' saxophone class was about 20 students, right? At the time or so, maybe just over 20. To get to North Texas, the class of undergrad and graduate combined was about 100, just saxophones players.
Yeah, that's
And
right.
so
Cause
they
like,
have nine jazz bands, I think. And the top jazz band, the 1 o'clock, is the one, and each one rehearses at that time, the 1 o'clock, the 2 o'clock, down to, I think, the 5 o'clock. And then some of them are rehearsing like at the same time. But the 1 o'clock, they've won many, 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 many Grammys over the years. I don't know what number they're at, but generally they release an album every year and it gets at least the nomination, if not the win. And Neil Slater was over that program for a long time. But yeah, so it's just like this giant cultural thing when you're there. If you play jazz, you gotta try out for the lab bands. Just you're there. You just get sucked into the stream. And so I did that. And I prided myself on not being a jazz major, but at least being able to play lead alto on the 3 o'clock, which said, okay, for a non-jazz major, it's not bad. But I'm telling you, the youth coming in, like there was the hunger level, the reading, it was out of control. But even there, similar to NIU, when I was there, as we, segue back to that, I was writing pieces for small ensembles within my composition degree. Once I finally got into my declared major my second year, I was starting to write pieces that informed who I was. Like I wrote an impressionistic harp, piano, and flute piece, which was kind of, more kind of, used a lot of fourths and fifths and, the harmonies and at least in the piano parts. When it comes to harp, there's certain pedalings that you can only do certain notes at a time, so I had to be careful with what I did. But it then also kind of informed the knowledge of how to write for harp. And then I, found a specific flute player and kind of wrote towards them. That's another thing. As you guys think about composition, think about the players that you know. I'm thinking like this is really all a journey. This isn't about like what you're doing right now. So in the future, as you kind of entertain the ideas of writing music, think of people that you know and having them play your music. Like your specific friends, whoever is like a virtuoso or a very specific sound that you love, like write a piece for them, because they will get together and kind of inform you on the things that they like to do or things that they find easy for the instrument or idiomatic or whatever. And that's one thing that I did. I hung out with harp players and would sit in their practice room and just talk to them about the instrument. And, they would say things like, people think all we want to do is go, it's like, okay, so what do you guys want to do? I thought I was one of those too. So then they would, break it down and be like, no, we can do things like this. And you ever think about, fingernails on the harp or harmonics or, different things or, and, encouraging composers not to write out the pedalings, different things that you wouldn't think that they would say. Even string players, getting together with string players, like a lot of composers, like, whether you're up bowing or down bowing, some composers say that they want a certain sound or they want a down bow on a certain beat. String players, a lot of them, depending on who you're writing for or what the scenario is, if you're in a recording scenario and it's about speed and time, sometimes the string players want to have the section leader tell the section where they're going to change their bow. Not having they might ignore the composer's thing. And then you're actually slowing down the recording process if you're telling them things that like they're like, trust me, we know where to rebow. But so, yeah, getting together with players that you guys know is something I highly recommend. The last time I did one of these calls, I really encouraged people to really, you know, send compositions that you're working on, even pieces, 10, 20 measures to a friend, you know, have them record it, you know, and send it back to you and you know, just hear little bits of it, because you might, that might also inform, you know, your approach over the years to never do a certain thing that everyone always does wrong or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So North Texas was a huge, the difference between NIU and North Texas for me, as far as getting players together and playing pieces, was at North Texas, I had to start paying people out of my pocket. people were in the gigging mentality. Dallas, you know, people are going straight to Dallas to gig on the weekends when you're in school. NIU, you know, is a little bit more, you know, homespun in that we're all in it together. We're making it happen. I'll play your piece. You play mine. It's great. But yeah.
Yeah, that was something that I really noticed too, you know, going from, so I went from NIU just to Chicago, mm-hmm. but that transition is shocking, right? You know, yeah. It's like you go from, hey, why don't you just come over, you know, like I'll warm up a pizza for you and let's read through this chart, right?
Right.
And then you get to the city, it's like, that'll be $75.
Yeah, exactly. Everything costs money all of a sudden.
Yeah. So, to the students out there listening, you know, take advantage of these opportunities as much as you can. You know, when you have access to, you know, all of these great teachers, all of these, you know, your fellow classmates that are so awesome, you know,
Age range here is, did you say from 12 to 17?
10
to like high school?
Yeah, 10 school? Yeah, 10 to high school. 10
okay.
years old to high school.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, man, Jermaine, like, I could spend like the rest of the afternoon talking to you and picking your brain, but
yeah,
since we're starting to get to about like 15 minutes too, let's transition to LA. So from North Texas,
okay,
you went to USC, right?
Yeah, I went to USC. They have a film scoring program. They might have changed the name of it at the time. It was scoring for motion pictures and television, and it's kind of like a one-year crash course. And here are the technical aspects of it. We honestly can't teach you how to write music. Hopefully you know how to do that based on the demo that you sent in. I mean, there are private lessons incorporated into the program because it's a program, but we can't teach you how to be an artist. We can teach you how to synchronize your stuff to picture. Wow. And then you're basically kicked into the world to fend for yourself. And that, like I said, the good thing about being at USC is there's a lot of student filmmakers there making short films, and you can make connections with them, which is what most people do, is try to score as many as you can. And you know, it's about quantity at that time. You have no experience really scoring a thing that's gonna actually be this thing that's not just an experiment. Like, these things are screened. These are these students' projects. They're getting grading on some of these things, on how you work with a composer. And some of them have shorts that go to festivals, and you know, hopefully they get deals to become filmmakers or whatever. But you know, like you said, in terms of my early experiences, you know, interning with composers, you know, it ends up being that you're really just getting their coffee half the time, or getting their tires changed, or a lot of that stuff that has nothing to do with music. Because as you get into it, you again realize all the things that you don't know. If you were to get this giant opportunity to do a giant thing, like the technical aspects of delivering this thing, working with all these different teams. Like, as I approach projects now, like, it's more like, okay, you have a certain budget, and within that given budget, what is the sound? Can I make that sound for that budget? And now I'm casting my music contractor, who's hiring the players and working within my budget. And then I may be producing some of it synth, you know, where are we going to record? You know, you need to know the sound of the rooms, the stages, like, you know, certain room, bigger rooms, like Sony is the big John Williams sound. I mean, you can also get that sound at Fox or whatever, but some of these stages are the most expensive stages in town, so you don't want to think about that. Not everything is John Williams, but then the players, you know, you by the time you get to this point, you know, just a crazy amount of players that you want to work with. And so that's a whole thing, you know, who's available and whatnot. And mm-hmm. like I said, you're working with different teams, who are going to be your copyists. Cause as a composer, you're like, I can't sit in here and be dealing with Finale and Sibelius when they're changing the movie, you know, two and three times and asking you, can you recalibrate your score, make it faster, shorter, louder, softer, funnier, sadder? Like, I can't be dealing with Sibelius and articulations at that point. Like, that's its, it becomes its own art form and its own trade at that point. You hire out folks to help you copy those parts. If you're using people that are reading music at a session, then you got who are your favorite engineers that do certain styles that you love, you know, so you got to have a knowledge of engineers, what they've done, and maybe a relationship with engineers and work. So when you get in the studio, you're not, oh, what, how would you mic this or whatever? Because I want it to sound like this, you know.
Okay. Well, actually, sorry to interrupt you, man. So let's break it down. Okay. Yeah. So you wake up, you have your cup of coffee, you check your email, and there's an email saying, "Can you do Coming to America too?"
I wish that was that. And then, I can actually walk you through that process, because that's really how the beginning happens. Kind of like, so with Coming to America, like, I've been out here 15, 16 years at this point, scoring short films and scoring indie films that people haven't heard of, and flying myself back and forth to Skywalker Ranch and recording up there and having different projects in different places, writing music for other composers. And as I talk about this stuff kind of casually now, that's kind of how I was talking to the head of music at Paramount on what we call a general meeting, which is just really he and I just getting reacquainted. It's like, I remember seeing you at this thing, but what have you been up to? And what are you doing really? And I'm just, you know, I'm doing this. And really, for me, like, I know that they own the rights to the Star Trek franchise. So I'm in there trying to get in, you know, how do I work with J.J. Abrams? And I want to do Bad Robot projects and Mission Impossible, because that's the Paramount, you know, those are their tent poles. And after my whole spiel about all these different things and working with the orchestras and my love of gospel, Randy Spindle, who's the head of music there, kept going, oh, we got Coming to America coming up. I think you might be a good fit. And I'm thinking, okay, of course, the black composer Coming to America. I'm like, no, I want to do Star Trek and Bad Robot and Mission Impossible. You're not listening. He's like, oh,
yeah, y'all didn't hear me. Y'all didn't hear me.
Yeah. And it's funny, because I'm telling you, not Coming to America, the one, our version, it's not this urban, you know, beats only small band with its six players. Not that the first one was, but in my mind, it was going to be the smaller thing where it's like this stylized thing where it's in this box of what's, you know, just create some beats and some African rhythms only. Like, what they needed was basically everything I've ever done in my entire life, which is, you know, the gospel stuff, the jazz stuff, the orchestral stuff. You know, how can you work with choirs? There's a scenario where I was on set, and, you know, the idea, and I was on set for almost 3 weeks total. They were flying me back and forth to LA to oversee these musical on-screen numbers. If any of you have seen the movie, like I said, it's PG-13. I don't know if everyone's age appropriate. Ask your parents. But so there's these musical sequences that in the script, it says that, you know, the doors open, the music's doing this, and, oh, there's dancers here coming out, they're doing this. So they needed music before they even shot the movie. And so as they were talking about the fact that this movie was going to happen, they were asking me to create these pieces, and maybe this might work. And as things kept working, they were just kind of like, why don't we just hire the guy? Like, it sounds like everything's just kind of working. And so, like I said, the next thing you know, I was in a room with the director playing him music, you know, because he was in town about a week or so before they were shooting. And by the time I was hired, they're shooting the movie, and they're like, all right, now we have some notes. We want this piece of music. It needs to be such and such a length. We're going to send it to set. You know, the director will listen, and then we're going to send it. And they're going to, you know, they would send me clips of what's called dailies, which is what they're shooting every day. And my music would literally be playing, and the actors would be moving from left to right. Or there'd be, like, for instance, I don't know if you know, the Wesley Snipes character is this militant, you know, antagonist in the movie. And so he would have things that he'd march out to, and they would be playing my music. And it's like, we were really making the movie as a team, like, truly, like, I was integrated from when I say the ground up. They were like, they gave me a badge. They were like, anytime you want to come to the Paramount lot and watch clips of the movie, you're welcome to come. We're going to fly you to set. It's going to be first class. Like, we want you, you know, every aspect of your involvement, so that it's not like there's no accidents and we're going to sneak through the back door. It was like, you know, we want you up front in the driver's seat. I got there to set, and they were like, so you see those percussionists over there? I haven't even put my backpack down yet. We want you to go over there and tell them how to hold the sticks. We want you to tell them how to play. And also, we want you to talk to the costumer because we want to know if there are any percussion instruments that they can be wearing as jewelry or anything. So I'm dealing with, like, the costume department at a certain point. There was a moment where I was casting. They had a scene where there's these street drummers. So it's almost like, you know, like I said, every aspect of the music. And so that's when I look back, I see why, you know, the head of music was so wild-eyed about, like, they had all these needs, you know what I mean? And so they were seeing this person that just seemed like, you know, a fit that could fulfill needs. It wasn't about, like, he's so cool or he's so whatever. And by the way, I have to point out that our director, Craig Brewer, who is white, you know, dealing with, you know, a subject and a franchise, you know, a movie that is super immersed in Black culture, in terms of the script, the story, he told the head of music when they were talking about music, you know, and who do you have in mind? Like Craig Brewer said, you know, it wouldn't hurt if the composer is Black. Do you know anyone that can do all this stuff that, you know, we can actually, you know, bring someone from the culture that is not just one of the guys that's on our, because when you're working at the studio level, it's about who's approved to work in the studios. They have these short lists of people that they've worked with before. And they, you know, they are really trying right now, like I'm telling you, on the phone as we speak, trying to break that glass ceiling with different films that I know that are coming out. There's certain people that I know that are in the conversation now that could not have been, them not been proactively on purpose about who do we have that we can have an open call for those things. So,
yeah. 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 That's beautiful, man. You know, the message I get from that is, you know, stay true to yourself.
Yeah.
And eventually the right opportunity will present itself. And it's just a matter of being ready and being prepared. Yeah. Right.
I see someone has a hand up, maybe.
So what parts of the movie did you play the music?
But the score, yeah, the score for the movie is basically the underscore that you hear. Most of the time when people are talking, the intro of the movie, even in the script, it described what the music was going to do as you see the Paramount logo and go over the lands of Zamunda. Like, all that stuff is written by me. It's, you know, there's orchestral music, there's choir, there's all these things. And that was all composed by myself, but I also oversaw a lot of the recording sessions. We have some cameos by folks like Gladys Knight and En Vogue that are in the movie. And they, even though I was composer, I was asked to oversee the process of the recording and just be involved in all aspects of the music. So I didn't write the pieces that the celebrities were really singing, but I was involved in, you know, some of the arrangements and the recording process of that too. But the score, Mike, don't forget to remind me to send you that, just so they can share that. That way they can hear exactly what I wrote. Because a lot of people don't know that songs are different than the score. You know, we say I did the music for a movie. It's not the songs, but, you know.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jermaine. Thank you so much for being so generous. And yeah, I will definitely send that information, get that information to the student.
How many movies did you play music in?
I don't want to say that I lose count because I haven't been keeping track lately, but I think it is kind of like over the 23 or 24 amount of feature films, but I've also done a lot of short films. I've also done a lot of music for other composers where I've written maybe one or two cues on a movie that's their score. Like, for instance, Christmas Chronicles was a big deal for me. Part two, they actually recorded with the London Symphony. So it's always been a dream to work with a group like that, where they're honestly, even Los Angeles, under our breath, considered the best players in the world. You know, we say that because everyone comes to LA, you know, we have the best players in the world, but really London.
And there's such a history with that too, with John Williams and Jaws and
all that stuff. And also the history of the opera, like, and as we know, underscore or scoring, a lot of it, the tradition of the medium of writing music for movies, underscoring movies, it really has to do with the philosophies that come from opera, where we would have motivic you know, activity or, you know, themes for characters, like in our major operas, to let people know who was doing what. You would have their theme or their you know, whatever, come, you know, play, which is really, you know, the whole philosophy of, you know, movies like Star Wars and those big things, that every character, every major character has a theme. It's a space opera. That's where those philosophies come from.
Yeah, that's dope. Yeah.
Can you do a quick like room tour? I see a whole bunch of equipment, but don't know what they're for.
Oh, goodness. This is gonna be a little crash course bumpy tour. And as I'm gonna launch Digital Performer over here because it's difficult to explain, but my studio is what I call very modest. It might look very messy if I move the angle from the camera that was set up, but my main computer is, and I need to get another one, is underneath. It's just the Tower Mac Pro, and it is, well, I'm launching Digital Performer here, is the program that I write cues with, and it's going to take a second to launch, but I will show you first. Obviously I got the monitor there. As you see everywhere, I've kind of got sound treatment in all the corners of the entire room here, just so the room has got kind of a dead, dry sound, so I can really, really hear the details of the highs and lows when I'm mixing. Because a lot of this, when you're dealing with television, the stuff that you do, it goes from your studio straight to the mix stage. Like, there's no, you know, mixing engineer. So here's Digital Performer. I'll just show you, and I could have done a screen share, which would have been more professional, but I'm gonna try and do this quick. It may not work, but so off to the, I'm gonna close this because this is just sound files, but here is, and there's not a lot of notes in this.
Hey, key. Jermaine, is that the same studio I was at when I came to visit?
No, it's actually, I moved. I'm in North Hollywood right now.
Oh, you're in North Hollywood.
There's two buildings of composers, like 10 of us in between the two buildings. There's five composers in this building, and a lot of them work in tandem with the composers in the other building, which has a full-on recording studio where I'm recording a lot of my stuff now and the next one. But anyway, this, I don't even know if you could see this, but this is the program. So I'm going to scroll through this. Each one of these things over here is a different instrument. So this is basically my template. So there's percussion, brass, strings, woodwinds, synth sounds, different string articulations, some experimental sounds, vocal sounds. I know you can't see, there's a giant light over there, but that is triggering this computer over here, which has what's called Viana Ensemble Pro. And in here, this is basically my keyboards. I know you probably won't be able to see this, but if I show you here, at the top, it's got the celestes, harps, pianos, Rhodes, ivory. So I have it set up to where in this template, basically it's going to the other computer, but I can separate out the different stems. The audio is coming in all on separate channels, so I can separate the reverbs and whatnot. If I click up here on this red thing, this is all the string articulations, and I've got them separated in some cases by libraries. Some of them it's just string effects. Woodwinds are here, brass are here, and percussion, and then synths. And like I said, each one of these is on its own. Like if I click on these, like this is all percussion, snares, pitch percussion, African, seeds, shakers, low percussion. It's separated so that if I need to do a pass of separating the sounds and send them separately, I can do that. And then down here, this is the actual computer that's hosting those instruments.
Oh, got the universal audio. Is that yeah?
Well, yeah, universal. Oh, well, yeah, the audio interface here is the universal audio one. Yeah. But it's a pretty modest setup. I have a bunch of backup hard drives down there, all the stuff that I've done over the years, as much as I can back up. But as far as gear, like I have the, you can't hear it, it's turned down, the Nord stage, which I don't.
Well, and actually, you know, sorry, Jermaine, since we're a little short on time.
Yeah, there's so much, it gets quite deep, like if I was to explain how this stuff actually works together.
Yeah, but would you be open? Like, maybe I can like virtually connect you two. I can, Jordan can give us, send your email to you, and then mm-hmm. you know, you guys can. I'm looking at Jordan's eyes, and he's just like,
"Oh, really? Where's
Jordan?" My yeah. second question was going to be, so do you donate to any charities like the Jordan Warren Foundation of impoverished studio artists?
Impoverished studio, like gear.
Like every studio artist, basically.
Like,
yeah, let's
see. Like just me.
I have Simi here. I can donate this guy.
I think I need him. No. Yeah.
How about in lieu of donations, I can virtually connect you two, and you guys can stay in touch. Would that be okay, Jermaine?
Oh, I'm fine. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of gets to be a rabbit hole, honestly. Of even when you talk about the sample libraries, because like even last week I bought one, you know, this movie that I'm working on now, it was like maybe 40 or 50 cues. And I'm like, how can I get parts of this library on every cue? it's possible, but like you just start to get like, you want more and more, and it just keeps going. So, and I could even point you in the direction of some of the really nice libraries to start off with. Because there's a lot of interesting things happening in the technical space of what libraries are hot, what's changing in the future, that blew my mind a couple months ago. I was like, oh no, don't tell me that's happening. After all this money.
Yeah, I know, right? Okay, well, you know, to wrap it up, there was one last thing I wanted to touch on to go back. You know, you mentioned earlier about when you take on a project, being able to find your way into it artistically, you know, not just accepting projects because they're available.
Yeah.
Doing that. So could you speak to that? And then we will wrap it up.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, staying true to yourself. Is that what you said, artistically speaking?
Yeah. And being okay with saying no to a project.
Yeah. That's a funny thing. Like, okay. So for instance, I'm just going to throw out there that people out here they say that there's a like the little triangle of reasons to take a project. One, if it's you know artistically or musically satisfying, or two, is it going to help my career, or B, is it a good opportunity to make money? And you want to have at least two out of the three most of the times. A lot of the times it has nothing to do with the money. And right now, so the project I was telling about, the scary horror film thing that I'm on and about to finish, I had said a long time ago I was never going to do any more horror films. I did a bunch of them, and it seemed like they never really led to the thing that I was trying to do. Like, they don't lead to, like, they don't lead to Star Wars, generally speaking. but, you know, a lot of the films, like, I'm seeing a lot of the, specifically with the producers that I'm looking at and working with, the films that they have coming up. Because they do such a wide array of stuff, this just happens to be the one that was next. And in terms of coming out of the pandemic last year, a lot of them, you know, the ability to even shoot a smaller movie like this was one of the only things they could have done, like last October when everything was really shut down and in the South. And this movie is an interesting one. It's, you know, like I said, it's a horror film that takes place on an old slave plantation. And it has actually shot on a slave plantation in New Orleans that mm-hmm. still exists. Not obviously not functional, but like there's a little bit of, you know, a nod to the realities of the fact that we have a history as a country that some of the stuff has gone down, which makes certain things, you know, scarier. But then again, like I said, the next couple of films that this, you know, these producers have coming up are all stuff. I mean, then there's one film coming down the line that hopefully we'll be talking about the next time we do one of these talks, is like a whole movie that takes place in the gospel space where it's about that culture, and it's just like so different from their last thing. And they do a lot of Kevin Hart movies too, so it's just funny how these things work out. And then there's another movie coming up, the one that I was telling you about now, that's the rom-com for Paramount starring Rebel Wilson. I mean, look, we just did Coming to America, so this is a totally different thing with just like humor and rock. Like that's what I pitched, that it would be this hard hitting edgy rock thing that I want to do artistically speaking, but at the same time, like, I don't tend to watch a lot of movies with people slipping on banana pills, you know what I mean? But it's an opportunity to do something that's fulfilling to me musically speaking. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, what it's going to lead to after that. And when I hear the conversations about what they think that I can do that has nothing to do with this, it's just, you know, being able to do it is just a blessing to be able to hopefully meet the requirements, work with some different people. It's a whole different circle of people. Like everyone involved is different. It's none of the same people from the last thing. And it expands that whole thing. It's just a real nice place to be in terms of what we can do and who we can connect with, you know. And half the stuff, a lot of the stuff, it's just our trade. It's about connecting with people. It's not even about me as a musician or me as a composer or Jermaine Steele, the brand. It's like we work with people, like these movies, at least. It's months at a time that I'm with these people, and like we're spending time influencing each other, you know, and our backgrounds and talking about culture. And, you know, I mean, this again, like this movie Senior Year coming up, it couldn't be any more white in terms of like culturally speaking. Like I call it the white girl rom-com. Like that's what it, I mean, it's Rebel Wilson. Like, you know, she's a cheerleader. She gets dropped on her head and then she has to go back to school 20 years later to finish her senior year. I mean, that has nothing to do with the culture I grew up with, but like the style of the music is so fun, and it's an opportunity to connect and share, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, connections. That's what it's about, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. Establishing connections, you know, nurturing those connections and strengthening those connections.
Right? Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, man, Jermaine, I'm so sorry. We're out of time right now. Like,
we'll have to do a follow up next year, and hopefully, the movies I talked about maybe doing are something that we're actually doing or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we will keep an eye out for them, and you know, we'll always be there to support you. You know, you're part of our community officially. You know,
yeah, like I said, there's two specifically next spring that we're going to be looking at, but there's one, this movie, the scary movie. And it's rated R, so I don't know. I'm not saying to go see it, but it's called Oracle.
Well, you know, if at the very least, you know, when the score is released digitally, we'll
pick it. Yeah. I'll have to send that to you.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jermaine Steagall, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today.
Hey,
big thank you to, of course, Orbert Davis, Jordan Mandela, Mark Ingram, the rest of the faculty. And of course, the students, thank you for sticking around.
Thank you guys for listening. I'm glad you weren't bored to tears.
Yeah, no, great questions. Thank you for your attentiveness and a great day today.
That concludes this episode of the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Jazz Cast Series. We really appreciate you tuning in. Sharing these stories wouldn't be possible without the support of listeners like you. To hear previous episodes, or to make a donation, or to simply learn more about our mission, please visit us at chicagojazzphilharmonic.org. See you next time for the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Conversation Series.